Just on that, we do need to use the microphone. I've got a microphone on, but the speakers aren't turned up, so I'm assuming you can hear me without it on. So it's actually on for the benefit of people not in Dunedin. I'm probably loud enough for them to hear anyway. As Vernon said, just some background. I was appointed to my job in 2006, and at the time inherited over 100 institutional international partnerships in a nice filing cabinet. Some of those partnerships included student exchange partners, and we have around 90 student exchange partners for undergraduate students to spend a semester or two. They span about 33, 34 different countries, and that's been fairly constant the last few years. We also have, as well as student exchange, we have our standard MOU, which covers research collaboration and graduate student and staff exchange and so on. So that's just sort of some background. And we also, I also inherited an internationalisation objective in the university's annual plans and things of growing the number of partners. I actually had some queries about that and said I wasn't sure that bigger was necessarily better, and from a perspective of managing the relationships and looking after them, I stumbled around 100, probably, of maintaining 100 close friends. So I wasn't too sure how much we were actually getting out of our partnerships. And as Vernon said in the introduction, it was lucky for me, probably, that David Skegg also shared some of those concerns. So we started looking at what could we do. It's also fair to say that at the time, internationally, this is a time that a lot of institutions have been reviewing their partnerships and their internationalisation plans. So if I sort of see international institutional relationships a little bit like a life cycle, and there's been quite a few years where the more the better, and we all want to be linked with absolutely everybody, and I sort of frequently refer to it as running around with an MOU in my handbag and saying, oh, you're nice, we seem to be getting on well, why don't you sign this? And there is actually still some of that happening around the world. I would like to think that New Zealand and Otago in particular is a little bit more advanced in the way it manages its international relationships, and that we only sign something if we truly believe there is something long-term and sustainable to come out of it. So you may be aware that we have a reasonably formal process, at Otago, where you do need to put forward a proposal to have an international relationship of the institutional variety, and put forward it to Internationalisation Committee and so on, which is a committee of Senate. This is partly to stop MOUs and things being signed up left, right and centre that then somebody else is left to manage when you've moved on either to another research collaboration or another institution. So part of what we were looking at is what is the objective of our institutional partnerships? How many can we actively engage in? So of all of the partnerships that we've got, they all come up for renewal on either a 3-year or a 5-year cycle. I think frequently being renewed, unless somebody's got a reason not to renew. Now what we're really looking at is what is the reason to renew? So it's a slightly different perspective. And then we started looking at should we be part of a network? And when David and I and others started looking at this, we reviewed some of the existing networks. I don't think there was a plan to necessarily start up our own network, but we started looking at some of the existing ones, and probably the closest to what we saw that we thought for what we were after was APRU, which is the Asia Pacific Rim Universities Network. It's very research focused. Membership is quite selective. It's not just one that you pay a big fee to and sign up and so on. And we looked at that a little bit. The University of Auckland is a member of APRU. It is possible to have more than one member in a country, but when we started looking at it, APRU, like many of the networks, is starting to suffer from the problem that they're getting bigger and bigger, and so it's harder to see what our members actually getting out of it. And I think the bigger a network gets, same as any sort of network, university networks are no different, the bigger they get, the harder it is to remember what you came together for in the first place. I actually had to do a presentation, an academic one, on networks last year, and some of you will be in the area of networks. There's been a lot of academic writings on networks in sociology and in the business school area and so on, but you can see that networks talk about non-market, non-hierarchy forms of organisational governance. So we're saying that all members of a network should be equal. So I think that's an important part to come out of that. They then talk about some different types of networks that isn't so significant here. Networks arise from the social interactions of collective interactions of multiple parties. again, it's this idea that you need to be interacting. There needs to be something going on, some activity for it truly to be a network. And they've generally been defined to include the multiplicity of ways in which at least two firms, this does come from the business literature, may be organised to cooperate for mutual benefit. We don't need to get too hung up on these definitions, but if you start looking at it, words like mutual benefit, non-hierarchical, social interactions, collective interactions and multiple parties, to me those are really key words in defining whether or not a network is a network in the true sense of the word and whether it's operating as one. There's also talk about they can be thought of consisting of a number of positions or nodes. Universities, you'll see, as actually mentioned in this 1997 definition. The next one talks about the set of nodes, the people or the organisations, are linked by a set of social relationships. And that can be a friendship. If you're on Facebook, you're part of a network. It could be funds transfer or overlapping membership or so on. So again, all of those sorts of things help guide us when we're looking at a network. What are we really looking for? So we're looking for a non-hierarchical organisation where there is activity, and that activity is not bilateral, it's across a range of multiple parties. And that makes this different to all of our bilateral partnerships that we've got. So by looking at entering into a network, we're not saying that we're setting aside bilateral partnerships, we're not saying that Otago and Glasgow's relationship is no longer significant, or Otago and Shanghai Jia Tong's relationship is no longer significant. We're saying we've got bilateral partnerships which bring benefits to both bilateral partners, but there may also be a group of universities out there that we could somehow come together for mutual benefit in a non-hierarchical way. So then we started looking, as I said, at all of the existing networks. This list is by no means exhaustive. I think if you Google university networks or type in an acronym, to be honest, or some combination of capital letters, you will come up with a university network that has a match to the letters that you put in. So as I said, we looked at APRU. It is one of the smaller ones. It's very much for research universities. It seemed to fit. Its basic philosophy seemed to fit with what we were looking for and how we thought about Otago. World University Network is a much bigger one. You can see from these that the names are not interesting. That seems to be a characteristic of university networks. Sometimes they're descriptive. LERU, the League of European Research Universities. I particularly like this one. The Institutional Network of the Universities from the Capitals of Europe. It's quite a mouthful and nothing very catchy. then you have others called the Academic Consortium or the Santander Group, which almost sounds like a business corporation or conglomeration of companies. So I'll get on to the name later, but you can see that there is a huge list, and I could have given you slides and slides of university networks. So we did look at some of these, and we also looked at some of the problems that were part of those networks, talked informally to colleagues at universities where we have a relationship and where they also happened to be a member of one of these networks, and what did they think. David Skegg actually visited the secretariat of APRU, which was the National University of Singapore, and talked to them about it and about running a network and so on. So we started informally gathering quite a lot of information. There is nothing wrong with any of these networks from the outside. Some of them were obviously not eligible to join. The Association of African Universities was not going to accept an application from Otago, no matter how good we were. There are others that we obviously could have joined. There are some, to be honest, that if you write out a cheque, you can join. There are others that you may have to, like APRU, go through a nomination process, and so quite different criteria for how you become a member, and that is something that we'll have to face with the Matariki network. There are also a number of discipline-specific networks, and our business school is the New Zealand Partner in PIM, which is Partners in International Management, so we actually do already belong to that network, or part of the university does, and that feeds back into a lot of our bilateral relationships, particularly for student exchange. So the bilateral partnerships and network membership are not exclusive things. So do we need another one? There's that list before, and as I said, we could go on and on. Are we doing the world a favour by adding another network, a university network, to the mix? Why don't we get over ourselves and join one that's good enough for the world universities, and why didn't Otago look at joining that? As I said, we went through quite an evaluation of networks, and fairly informal, but talked widely to different people. We looked at the costs of belonging. The costs of belonging to some of those networks are significant. the benefits, some people could talk quite glowingly about the benefits they'd received from being members of Network. Others, it was difficult to tell whether they knew anything about their university's membership. We also looked at websites for the different networks to see how active they were. Was it just presidents and VCs getting together, or was there some sign of doctoral colloquia or some sort of other activity or something happening? And who were their members? So how selective was membership? Remember that we already have this 100-plus institutional relationships. We already are a member of the PIM network. And I have to say, Otago has some top partners around the world, and I definitely can't claim credit for all of them. Many of them were in place before I started. But we have some really, really good university partners. Through the Student Exchange Program, we send our students to some of the top universities in the world. But so what was it that we were going to gain by either joining one of these existing networks or setting up our own? What the conclusion was that a small active group with common characteristics basically is the best definition of an active university network. And I think if you go back to those definitions of a network that I put up before, that is not inconsistent with those definitions. So remember, we test from the definitions, that we were looking for multiple interactions happening across all of the parties involved in the network. It's non-hierarchical, so there's not lead universities deciding who else is going to do this and that and so on. So basically the conclusion we came to was pretty consistent with what others have said about networks in general, that you need a small group where interaction is happening across all of the members, not just a subset of the membership of the network. So we then thought, well, we haven't found one that matches what we want. And so then, as Vernon said, quite a big long list of potential partners. Remember, we didn't know if any of them wanted to jump into our network with us, but we sat down and went through some universities. Coming up with that list, there was quite a lot of talking around the place. We reviewed our own partners, so we started with that 100-odd partners that we already had. We also reviewed our partners' partners, because remember, that's how a network works. You know, who's your friend and can I be your friend? And if that's their friend, maybe that's a friend we'd like to have as well. We did look at rankings, such as Shanghai Jiaotong and Times Higher Education. We looked at their location, and I'll come back to that in a minute. We looked at the date they were founded, and obviously across the world there's huge variety. We might be New Zealand's first university, but we're by no means the oldest university in the world. But that, again, was significant. And we looked at the number of postgraduate and undergraduate students that they had, because not every university has a student body made up like ours is. And we also looked at the population of the city in which the main campus was based, remembering that many universities like us are multiple campuses. So we looked up where was the main campus for that university. We also then started looking at research collaborations and activities. Where were things already happening? So within this review of our own partners, which were the ones we felt were quite active? And that may have been activity in terms of student exchange. Were we sending lots of students there and lots of students coming back? Did we know that Professor so-and-so in Department X was collaborating with somebody from there, and so on? So this was quite a big list. We then met with UWA in Perth and Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. We're extremely strong partners of Otago's and have been for a number of years, and they were very keen on this idea initially of how the three of us could work more closely together, but then they got interested in the idea of a network. So there was an initial meeting held here in Dunedin with Queen's, UWA and Durham University from the UK to talk about it a little bit more, and we went through this list and they put in their suggestions and so on. And from that, I guess, came a shortlist of potential partners, and David Skegg undertook to visit them in person. We did want people to sign up to this network because they were personally committed and could see the benefits of it, not just this write a cheque or join because it was a good thing to have the logo on your homepage. At that point, we had no logo, so we couldn't offer them that anyway. So David met with some of them, and that's basically how the origins of the network came about. The key criteria that we came down to was that excellence in teaching and research were equally valued. So hopefully when you look at these criteria, you'll recognise Otago in there. We were looking for like friends. We were looking for people like us, basically, or universities like us. And the reason for that is we wanted to ensure that there would be lots of activities that we could participate in. We wanted a university or a partner where leading researchers were directly involved in teaching, because that is not the case in all universities of the world. We wanted education to be more than just what was happening in the classroom, but that there are other opportunities and that people talk about a rounded education experience or other opportunities for students to learn. We also decided that it was important that they were outside of their capital city. So earlier on that list of networks, I found one that is the European Capitals University Network. We actually started looking at what are some of the problems that Otago faces I agree totally. What are some of the problems that Otago faces, and how do those things relate to the fact that we're not Wellington and we're not Auckland? And I know Auckland's not the capital, but Auckland is probably the best known city name internationally. If you think of New Zealand, you'll think of Auckland. So what were some of the things? We are a very strong presence in our local city. That obviously brings with it benefits and challenges, and I think this particular week probably more challenges than benefits. But again, it does affect the way we do things at Otago, that fact that Dunedin and Otago have a strong interdependence. We wanted, again, as I said earlier, a mixture of undergrad and postgrad students. We wanted a broad range of subjects available, so not just a university that was a science university or a technology university or whatever, and a shared commitment to advancing human knowledge and making a difference through research. And that's quite a grand statement, but I guess it reflects the philosophy or values that we were looking at. That one's quite hard to measure when you look at universities from the outside, and there was a little bit of reliance on people who knew institutions and so on. So just looking back at these, the capital city one of the things we were looking to do with the network is benchmarking, or being able to share best practice, not just in terms of curricula and research, but also in terms of things like student services and so on. So if you're a university like Otago in Dunedin, or Queen's in Kingston, or Durham in Durham, or Tübingen in Tübingen, they are all universities like us. They're all outside of their capital city. They're all, but they also have this student population that is very much a part of the way the university operates. The term campus university was bandied around, but that actually means different things in different people, different places. And interestingly, some of our partners always say, we're not a campus-based university. We talk about being a campus-based residential university, but internationally that can actually translate as like a university that's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's campus-based and not a city university. So there's some slight, you know, we might say AUT was a city university. Some of our partners in the network actually describe themselves as city universities, not campus-based. So you do need to watch the use of those words, and that's why we were a little bit more explicit in the criteria. So the Matariki Network of Universities was born, and this is from the website, but it says it's been established to enable universities to enhance diversity, share ideas and expertise, and learn international best practice from each other, and then refers back to some of the things that came out in the criteria. Do you want to know about the name? Okay. the name was probably, choosing the partners and David going around and visiting them was probably the easy part with hindsight. And the name, there's more emails in the file on how to choose a name. You may have picked up from the comments I made before that I'm a little bit, you know, I thought the names of most of the networks around were pretty boring, and so we ran the risk of falling into the same trap ourselves. And I was beginning to see why they were called things like the World Universities Network or the League of European Research Universities, because actually selecting a name was incredibly difficult. We are not and do not set out to be a network with geographic worldwide coverage, and I think that's a really important thing. We are not the World Universities Network. The focus is much more on those criteria that I put up before. It's not a case of having one in Asia and one in Europe and one here or one there. And that has positives and criticisms about it as well. But trying to find a name that meant something to everybody around the world or said something about the network was extremely difficult, and names went backwards and forwards for well over a year, I think, and to the point that when David and I went to the first official meeting of the network in Durham last February, 2 days before it, everybody had just sort of given up, and it had been suggested it be called the Otago Network of Universities, because they were going, oh, well, you've driven it, and that recognises your role in things. I thought that was sort of odd, because we already have the Otago Holdings, and that's our companies and things, and to put on the website Otago University, a member of Otago Network of Universities, also looks slightly strange, so I thought, what would we get from it reputationally and things? Anyway, then we found out one of the reasons they liked Otago was it actually sounded exotic and interesting from the other side of the world. So we thought, so we started looking at some other words, New Zealand words, that they might like as well, and consulted with Darren Russell and other people and put forward some names. And Matariki, I think, was a really good choice, actually, and we were delighted that they all liked it after it had been Googled in every language possible so that it doesn't mean anything terrible anywhere. Matariki is the name, obviously, for the Maori New Year. It's the Pleiades Star Cluster, which is also known as Subaru for some of you who drive the car. It's also refers as the Seven Sisters, and there were seven members. So it has a lot of significance. And we thought, these are all historic universities, but we're looking to do something together. And so it sort of fits the idea of new year and new beginnings and things as well. So there is a little bit on the website if you want to read up about it. But anyway, it was a name that when it came down to it was actually quite an easy sell, and it was a pity we hadn't tried 6 to 10 months earlier to get it. But and it has definitely created a lot of interest around the world. We get quite a few hits on the website because of, you know, the name, and people often take the time, as Vernon said, we're currently the secretariat, and I do get emails just asking about the name, and that sort of gets them thinking about the network. So overall, it's been positive. There was talk about Matariki Network of Universities. It doesn't say we're the World Universities or the European Research Universities, so what else did we need to say about the network, and hence the tagline, Partnering for a Better World. I think coming up with taglines and things is difficult, probably even as difficult as choosing a name for the network, and it, you run the risk of it sounding a little bit clichéd or corny, I guess, and I had concerns a little bit about, I thought it sounded almost like Deloitte's or something like that, something they might say. But in actual fact, the idea is that we're all good institutions in our own right, but we've come together to do something even better or learn from each other. And there's the research theme that runs throughout the network. So the Partnering for a Better World is the tagline, and it is supposed to be central to all network activities. So what are we doing by ourselves? What could we do better by doing it as a network? And that's where the Partnering for a Better World comes. It also reflects the fact that we are all in local communities where we have a responsibility to work with the local community, and it also very much, one of the main activities for the network is an annual research workshop, and when we review themes for the next few years' workshops, that's one of the things, is what is it that we're doing together, and where's sort of the social role or the social responsibility that's coming from that research. So hence the tagline. The idea is that the network, that we will share best practice in operational areas, and I think often we talk about benchmarking. With the network, we're talking about deep benchmarking, and the idea that we will share much more confidentially than what we may share in terms of other benchmarking activities that the university participates in. Curricular development, there has been talk and some enthusiasm from some parts of the network for joint postgraduate programs and things. I personally think we're a little bit, a little way off this, just because the idea of moving students around seven partners or even three of the seven partners and the geographic distances and things involved is quite difficult. But obviously for our European partners, joint postgraduate programs is something they're very used to. So we're currently working on some different options by virtually linking students. Kevin Clements here in Peace and Conflict Studies has currently got one of our internationalisation of the curriculum grants to do exactly that. He's bringing people from the different network partners together to look at ways that they can share curriculum virtually, do guest lectures and so on for each other. And I think particular areas, there's real scope for getting perspectives of students in seven different countries on a problem, and peace and conflict studies is a good starting point for that. So, and we're looking at that in some other areas as well at the moment. International mobility opportunities for staff and students, and this is academic staff and general staff. The partners, Otago was quite lucky in that the eventual members of the network are all actually existing Otago partners that we already had a good relationship with. We actually have bilateral student exchanges with all of the partners, which are being maintained and enhanced. The exception is Dartmouth. Dartmouth actually sends us students on study abroad, so fee-paying single semester. So we thought we'd offer them the opportunity of exchange. Interestingly, I don't know what you know about Dartmouth, but they pay significant fees there. And for a Dartmouth student, the idea of paying their fees at Dartmouth and coming to Otago on exchange is not a financially attractive option. So we're looking at how we can include some sort of bilateral exchange between students in a different way. And then research collaboration is the other one. So the partners are Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, University of Western Australia in Perth, Durham, Otago, Dartmouth, Tübingen in Germany, and Uppsala in Sweden. I'm assuming most of you know about these universities, but I'm happy to answer any questions. But if you look at them and what you know about them and think back to the criteria, I hope you'll agree that we have stuck to the criteria that we said. Obviously, the University of Western Australia, it's not in its capital city. It's in its capital city for its state, but it's not in its capital city for Australia. It's in a larger city than all of the rest of us. But I think there's always going to be extremes and people that meet all of universities that meet all of the criteria slightly more closely. It would be fair to say that UWA, with its location in Western Australia, and its relationship with the eastern states of Australia, faces similar challenges to the rest of us may do in dealing with our capital city or other large population areas. So these are all universities that having students living on campus is an extremely important part of what they do. If you've been to any of them, some of them you will know, you'll recognise the similarities with Otago as soon as you get there. Queen's and Kingston. Kingston is a small place on Lake Ontario and much, much colder than Dunedin, as are most of the partners actually, but very much a residential-based university. Queen's, interestingly, for many years, Otago has shared a lot of resources and shared a lot of best practice with them. Some of you will be familiar with, from a few years ago, the posters that went round when we were having particular problems with couch burning and things here on campus. And there were posters that went round basically along the theme of, when you do this, you're trashing your degree, which were aimed at students. They were actually came from Queen's with some... They don't burn couches in Kingston, they burn cars. so it's something for ours to think about. So Tübingen, small city in Germany, in Baden-Württemberg, in the southern half of Germany. Obviously not Frankfurt, not Berlin, not Munich. Very old historic university and a very good university. Uppsala, again, in, not in Stockholm, in Uppsala in Sweden. So Durham, not in London. So all of us, particularly I think Queen's, Tübingen, Durham and Otago, incredible similarities between them and the location and things. And probably no surprise that our students enjoy going there on exchange because they chose to come to Otago, and then when they go there, they're sort of getting a similar experience but in a different part of the world. So I think a lot of the other thing that has really struck me is how much existing research collaboration there is among staff, and I probably don't know the half of it. We're trying to get an idea of how many people already are researching with people from at least one of these partners, but an incredibly active collaboration already in place informally as well. So, again, that shows that these universities are similar and are doing similar types of work at a similar level that we are. David Skirgoffen says we're very lucky in that we're in a group of universities that are actually ranked higher than us, so it is important that Otago maintains a strong commitment to the network because we've probably got more to gain reputationally from that perspective. But I think, you know, all of them are top universities in their area. Going back to that one I had about other than location that we talked about when they were first founded, all of the partners are among the oldest in their own national context. So Uppsala and Tübingen were actually founded in 1477, so a little bit older than Otago. UWA is actually celebrating its centenary this year. So we're all within a few hundred years of each other, but within our national context, we are the oldest universities. And again, that's a particular role that those institutions play in their national context as well, and that's something else that we can learn from each other, how we do that. You know, do you run the risk of being seen as the traditional conservative one, or what are you doing in different areas and things? So there's best practice and so on that can be shared there as well. So is there any questions on the members themselves, or we can come back to that later if you want to? The plan is at the moment to consolidate with the seven members. We're not open for new members at the moment, nor have we been flooded with inquiries. But I think it's important that we learn more about each other and work with each other more closely so that we ensure there's a strong focus and a strong core of activities that are happening before the network looks at other members. We have been asked, well, why haven't you got somebody from Asia, or, you know, somebody from China, or why haven't you got this and why haven't you that? That's a fair question, but I think it's important to go back to that list of criteria. And the reality is it would be quite difficult to find institutions that match those criteria in some countries. That is not to say that in the future membership wouldn't be looked at that, and there's been talk about associate membership and different forms of membership as well. Given that we've all got a commitment to international progress and social responsibility, it may be that we take on a university that's sort of in a mentoring role or something like that, and some of the members are quite keen on in doing that as well. So there's different, you know, if we're saying that we've got best practice in this particular area, then can we share that with a university in a developing country? And there are opportunities for the network to move into those sorts of areas in the future. So in summary, we're a closely knit network of universities. I have to say that the meetings I've been to and the people I know from the different ones, incredible personal commitment by senior people and other people across the universities, and I think that's a really important thing and something that we'll be working hard to maintain and sustain. As well as David retiring this year, there are actually, I think, four of the seven VCs or presidents changing this year, so quite a significant time fairly early on in the network to ensure that that commitment is maintained. We do share very common goals and values and characteristics. None of us are putting aside our bilateral partnerships. We're not saying we're not interested in our other partners at all, and I think that's an important message to get out both to you and to our partners overseas. But we're just looking at what can we do as a network that we couldn't do bilaterally. Geographic location and representation is not the primary criterion, so we're not setting out to be a worldwide network. And as I said, there's already a range of formal and informal collaboration already in place. A lot already happening, and I'm sure some of you could tell me more things that are happening as well. Key factors for success is that the founding members do embody the key characteristics. When I look back over the last couple of years and the list of different partners that we looked at, I think the us plus the six partners that we've come up with, I think they very much all fit, some within, you know, slightly more closely than others, but they're all comprehensive universities with medical schools, and they're all older universities, and they're all in small locations and so on. So a lot of the things we talked about, as I said, there's very strong personal commitment, quite amazingly strong, actually. Whenever activities and research themes and things have been discussed, people do go back to the values of the network. So what was the network set up for? What are we hoping to achieve with it? Maintaining the commitment will be important, and not just at the top level, but right throughout universities. People need to see a reason. I think you all need to see a reason. What can you get out of us being a member of Matariki Network? This isn't just something that goes on our website, but we need to be living it and actively using it. And through that, delivering benefits to individuals. So the thing you probably all came for, the last slide, is the funding initiatives. And the network was officially launched in May last year, and probably within about half an hour of the press release going out and the website going live, emails started coming in going, oh, I work with so-and-so at Uppsala, and what money is available, and I work with so-and-so somewhere else. So at this stage, we are trying to run the network on a user-pays, low-cost basis. Like I said, one of our criticisms of some of the other networks was that there was huge amounts of money involved in secretariats and all sorts of things. When we talk about the Matariki secretariat, it's some little corner of my desk, I think, and various staff already in the office who we get to do different things. So there has been no secretariat established. It's just being done. But we have looked within our own institution at changing some of the existing funding around so that we can prioritise Matariki collaboration. Student exchange, as I said, we already had bilateral relationships with these partners, except for Dartmouth. We already give all of our students going on exchange through our Otago program, already get a travel grant within the existing budget. Jason can answer questions on it. He's here. But we have rejigged it so that now students going to a Matariki partner get a slightly more money than if they went to one of our other partners. Given that some of the partners are actually in expensive places like Uppsala, it's no bad thing. And it, again, it's the belief that by having an active flow of students bilaterally, that will help staff know more about each other's partners and courses and so on, but also just keep the name of the network and the partners there. Again, not at the cost to our other exchange partners. We have internationalisation of the curriculum initiative grants, and there was already priority given if you put in a grant application that was involving an existing formal partner of the university. Again, there is now top priority given if you put in a grant application that involves not all of necessarily all seven Matariki partners, but at least, you know, two or three of them. And Kevin was quick off the mark with that last year and got the first one that went to a Matariki for his peace and conflict work. The Matariki Network of University Travel Awards, I think applications currently open actually until the end of this month. These are top-up grants of up to $2,000, and there'll be two rounds a year. These are for academics who are either on RSL or conference leave anyway, and this is sort of basically an additional grant to help you spend time at a Matariki partner. So if you were going to be in the UK and you wanted this helped you get to Durham or something like that, that's the sort of thing that those traveller awards are for. They will not get you, $2,000 will not get you to Sweden. It won't get you, might get you to UWA, but the idea is that this is if you're already on some other approved conference or sabbatical leave that you can go and spend some time, either to start up collaboration, but you do need evidence of who you're going to be collaborating with, not I'd like to visit, or to build on existing collaboration. The annual research workshop, which is a core activity for the network, last year the first one was held at Queen's and it was on sustainable energy. We have committed to sending academics to that every year, so obviously if this was happened to be in your area, then that was something else that there is funding available for. This year it's going to be at Tubingen and on a theme, the actual wording needs confirmed, but it'll be around bioethics and health, and we're currently confirming the topics hopefully for the next 2 or 3 years, and there'll be information about that on the website as well. With regards to the research workshop, quite a few people have said to me, oh, I'd really like my research area to be a focus for the workshop. If it's not chosen as a workshop topic, it's not because we don't want to encourage collaboration across the network in that particular area. It's just that the seven universities have to get together and agree that this is something that all seven can contribute to, and actually that narrows down the topics. There's many topics that five could do or six could do, but the annual one is one that's supposed to be of interest to all seven partners, and it also has to fit with that theme about what the Matariki Network was set up for. So it is not to preclude other research get-togethers or colloquium or anything like that. It's just that the official one will be very much lined up with the theme and something that all seven can participate in. I think that's about all I had to talk about, but I'm very happy to take questions.
Just a reminder that this is supposed to be a forum, not just a presentation.
Yes, so you have to participate.
Right, go. That is working, I presume. I can't hear it. Sarah, I'm quite interested in what Matariki Network has done in terms of benchmarking.
Yep.
And particularly operational cost-benefit, drill-down, performance-type things that would be quite useful. I mean, the Commonwealth Universities used to run a similar program, and there's a number in Australia touting for sort of the business and joining into it. Where are we with that?
So far on benchmarking, it's been done fairly informally. Last year, UWA initiated a project that was around higher degrees students, and Charles Tustin's office supplied quite a lot of information to that. Durham University, obviously in the UK, they're moving into a completely different arena with setting fees. Uppsala University, Sweden, is now setting international fees, so there's been quite a lot of exchange of information about fee setting and things, but that's probably more sharing best practice and sharing ideas. So I think there will be a formal benchmarking program established. At this stage, it's been areas where there's been interest in doing it. I should have said that one of the activities for this year, actually, you reminded me, David, seeing you, is that there is going to be a get-together of student services directors for a workshop, remembering that one of the things we all share in common is the advantages and disadvantages of being a university in a small town and the impact of student life on the city and vice versa. And so Durham has agreed to host a workshop this year, or probably in the next, in the coming year, coming 12 months, on student services, and there is going to be part of that is going to focus on student and alcohol consumption and sharing best practice, as well as other student services. We've had some visits from around accommodation because of the residential colleges being important to all of the different universities. So our accommodation services director did visit last year some of the Matariki partners. So there's those sorts of best practice sharing ideas are starting. But I think I would hope that in the next year or so, maybe at the next formal meeting, there'll be a more of an established benchmarking program, and we'll look at exactly what we've got that we can share. Yeah. Don't get coffee till 4:30, apparently, so you've got 10 minutes to keep asking questions or you'll be sent home with no coffee.
So Simon Ryan, Languages and Cultures. A question sort of goes beyond the student exchange travel grants to the area where there may be sort of postgraduate involvement, and where the, you know, the costs, in a sense, would probably exceed what's available, say, on a Humanities Division grant and so forth. I'm fielding one inquiry at the moment for a student who wants to partake in a symposium at Queen's University at a special centre for excellence that they have there. Is there any thought about how postgraduate exchange or postgraduate involvement might be funded or given a bit of a boost by Otago?
I think the funding issue is going to continue to be a challenge. Like, these are the things that have been formally established at this stage, and as I said, each university at the moment, we're not putting into a membership. Each university is just paying for people to participate, and it's being done differently within each of the seven members. In fact, one thing as Secretariat that I want to do in the next couple of months is get a handle on how each institution is dealing with this, so that information can go on the website as well. At this stage, from Otago's perspective, there's been nothing specifically put in place for graduate students. I guess... I guess that's, I would hope that within divisions, that if there was access to some sort of funding and things, that it would be given priority if it allowed them to attend something.
I mean, I think that's the issue. I don't actually know about the other partners, but we have a very devolved system in Otago. Mm. The others presumably don't.
No, they're all handling funding slightly differently.
So, you know, the first gut reaction is that the case would have a lot of leverage, but it would tend to be dealt with in this university at the divisional level. But, you know, the future may, if the partners can agree, we may well come up with a different model.
One of the things they have asked for, that, again, based on a lot of the emails and communication that I had through the Secretariat email address, was, like, we've put in place the travel awards to enable academic staff to move around, but a lot of people were asking about funding for longer periods of time, and I did suggest at the last executive meeting that we actually looked at a Matariki fellowship or something that would go across all seven universities and that people could apply for. That was quite positively received, so I think by the next meeting I've got to put a paper together on how that might work. So I think we've started off from this user pays basis, but the reality is there may be some central funding committed to the network itself that will have money, and, you know, whether graduate research students, whether that became part of that as well. But in the short term, Well, I don't have an answer, sorry, Simon. No, yeah.
Interestingly, this is slightly to one side of the topic, but there's at least one arrangement within the university. Interestingly, there are arrangements already for funding overseas travel awards of postgraduate students that, in fact, are not particularly well taken up. There's a thing called the Elman Pool Travelling Bursary, which has funded, it's been running for several years now, and there are very few takers each year. So the competition is not particularly high, and you know, they get a grant of thousands of dollars, $20,000 typically, to go and either study in another university or perhaps take in a conference and then go and work in a lab overseas, that sort of thing. So I think, you know, there are already ways you can deal with this in the university, but Matariki offers another possibility, certainly. Right. Anybody else?
I knew you would have to say something.
But I'm not asking you for money, man.
Oh, really?
Although I think that grant you just mentioned will now be inundated.
Yeah,
with,
exactly. There'll be no shortage of applicants.
So. I'm actually more interested in the teaching at the moment, because it seems to me that the network's great, but you said everyone's coming along to see what the funding is, and it's all about travel awards and things like that. But that strikes me that one of the things you can really leverage off is teaching,
yep.
And the possibility that you don't travel, it's virtual.
Yep.
And I'm already involved in discussions with people at UWA, for example, in teaching science communication. Mm-hmm. But there are inherent problems in the system that come not from the technology. We can do the technology. We can all contribute to teaching. But it's the way our various universities structure their courses and the timetabling and things like that. So do you have any sort of, is any work being done on that sort of thing?
Because last year one of the activities that they wanted investigated was this joint postgrad program idea, some of us who were attending another conference, but there was members from all of the network partners there, we got together anyway to look at it. And like I said, I think our European counterparts thought this would be easy until we started going through. And I've always said, not just in relation to this, but with international education, if all of the universities agreed on a common academic calendar, life would be so much easier, because the reality is when we're studying, they're on break and so on. I think Kevin's initiative with Peace and Conflict Studies is one I'm watching with great interest to see how they work through it. It's a good example in that most of them already know each other quite well and have strong research collaborations, so they're used to working with each other. And they're getting together here in May for 2 or 3 days, I think, to go through and try and come up with a plan on how they can do this through shared teaching. Some of it may be that, you know, using podcasts and recording and things, so it's not all going to be shown at the same time around the world, but that a resource will be built up and be available. Case studies could be shared, those sorts of things. And like I said, getting students together virtually on projects and so on, when you can find the time of the year that you're all doing assessment. So I think there's a few different areas. There were a range of areas that were come up, that were sort of drawn up where, apart from peace and conflict studies, other areas that the seven thought that there was potential for them to do. Science communication didn't come up, but if you're already working with UWA, we could definitely look at what else is going on at the other institutions. And my feeling is if we can get 4 or 5, that's a good start. We don't have to get all 7. And there is agreement about that, that not all 7 are going to be involved in each project. Indigenous studies is another area that's being looked at the moment, which probably will involve 4 or 5 of the partners and so on. So there's basically, if there's enthusiasm there in a particular area, then we can definitely look at how we can facilitate it. But I think, not to put any pressure on Kevin, but I think the outcome of his workshop in May, and I hope to spend some time at it, it'll be interesting to see how they all view it and what the realities and practicalities of it are.
Just to add to that, about 5 years ago, in my previous job as BBC Sciences, I went to Queen's to actually try to negotiate a postgraduate program across Otago and Queen's. And after a lot of to and fro looking at different subject areas, we looked at epidemiology, physics, mathematics, chemistry,
photography. We settled on geology in the end as a trial to see whether it would work. And I came back here very enthusiastic and put our Department of Geology in touch with their Department of Geology, and they spent a lot of time discussing an arrangement whereby we could have a master's level interchange of students. It never worked, and the main problem was actually the two different systems between New Zealand and Canada, and also the system for accrediting the courses, in the sense that, you know, we have QAP, they have a provincial system and a national system that they had to go through. Sounded as though their system would take about 20 years. Our system takes about a year. But the main issue really was the fact that what they perceive as a master's degree is quite different from what we perceive as a master's degree.
Yeah,
so we couldn't integrate too.
Since the formation of the network, Queens and Durham have signed an agreement to set up joint postgraduate programs. Queens now has a number of them. Durham is starting to have some. Uppsala and Tubingen have them. It would be fair to say that probably Otago and UWA, or New Zealand and Australia, a little bit, I won't say behind, but we're not as far developed when it comes to joint postgraduate programs between international partners, and there's a number of reasons why. Also affecting it is our fairly limited number of coursework programs and things at master's level. So when you start talking about master's students working jointly, if there is a course, then there's a curriculum. If it's just a research relationship with a supervisor and a thesis, it's more difficult to see how you'd work together. So I think if we start looking at some of our master's areas where there is a taught component, then there is an area where you can share curriculum and things, where and they would be good places to start. And then we'd just have to try and overcome dates and work around that. There's nothing to say that students couldn't spend some time at one of the partners or two of the partners if they wanted to, but I guess my feeling is that from a New Zealand perspective, we couldn't even make that compulsory in one of our courses because we'd just get nobody taking it up. There'd be a huge amount of arranging going on and absolutely nobody moving once it came down to it. Whereas from Tubingen to Uppsala or to Durham is a much easier move, and there's great Erasmus Mundus funding and available in Europe. So part of through the network, you know, it's not a sole driving force, but there is definitely potential to access external funding and things like student mobility funding that we wouldn't have been able to access by ourselves, but that we will be able to access through network partners. So I think there'll be more of that come out as well.
Anybody else would like to ask a question? Margaret.
Sarah, I noticed, just referring back to the list that you had up earlier of other networks that there were, that some of our partners, like UWA, are partners of other networks, like Universitas 21. Is that it?
No, UWA is a member of the World Universities Network.
Right, okay. I guess there's a potential there to belong to lots of different networks. Yep. Do you think there's perhaps any
UWA's move there? Was actually quite interesting. And that they had been very keen and are very keen about the Matariki network, and about a week after we all got together and had the initial meeting, then they announced they were joining WN. Interestingly, they see it in a completely different way. To them, it's just a badge to put on their website, and it gives them access to some research collaboration and things that they wouldn't have otherwise had. UWA see the Matariki network very much as sort of the student services, teaching and close research collaboration within a close partnership. So it's almost like they've got their big network and then they've got a smaller network and then they've got their bilateral partners. So it's just a different perspective. But when I was there last month, I was trying to find out how much was actually happening within WUN, and there's mixed views, I guess, on that. But I mean, our membership of Matariki doesn't preclude us joining something else, but I think we'd just have to assess what the objectives of each of them were and whether there was any point in doing that. So I don't think it's necessarily a one network fits all sort of approach, but UWA's move was interesting, but they just seem to see it, or so they say, as a badge that sits on their website, which is a reason for joining some networks, I guess. Yeah.
Now, the cakes have arrived, so please ask your questions quickly.
Are there any other questions or comments? Anybody want to add anything? Come on, I was only teasing about the cakes. Is there anything you want to say to finish off?
So no, but if anybody has any questions that they think of afterwards, either drop me an email or give me a call and I'd be happy to talk through. I think.
And you're hanging around for tea, are you?
Yeah, yep, I'm hanging around. Thank you, Vernon. The network, it was only launched in May last year, so we're under a year, actually, since it officially was launched. And I think it was interesting at we have sort of this annual executive meeting, and it was interesting this year I did a review for the meeting of what had been achieved in the last year, and there's actually quite a lot, you know, apart from the formal activities, a lot of informal activities and things that have come to light. And I think really now the key focus is on ensuring that it's embedded throughout the university and that different people can see how they can use it. And the way one department or one person uses it may be completely different to the way somebody else does, because it is multidimensional. You know, the student services workshop won't be of great interest to some of you. It will be of interest to others. You know, and we can definitely facilitate if you are interested in collaborating with one of the partners or visiting one of the partners or so on, then I'm more than happy to put you in touch with contacts at the other institutions and facilitate that, particularly if you're interested in the travel awards and things and you think that you know that that university is doing something in your area but you're not particularly sure who to contact, then if there's anything like that that I can help with, then just let me know.
Thank you. I'll formally close it off, but as I said before, there's tea and coffee and fruit juice and water there for refreshments. Please join us, and thank you all for coming. Thank you particularly those who participated in terms of asking questions. That's great, but also I'm sure you've all learnt something, and we'll expect your applications for travel awards very soon. Thanks very much. Bye.